Hey, Anna, when's the last time you've seen the Milky Way?
Have I never?
Never? Oh my gosh, you're so deprived.
Are we talking about the candy bar?
No, we're talking about the milky substance-like thing that goes across the sky. When you're way out in the dark, away from the city, you could see this ghostly glow from horizon to horizon. That is the Milky Way.
Sorry.
Well, do you know the
origin?
I think
I ruined this intro.
No, it's great because I don't think a lot of people have seen it. But it's something that fascinated the ancient astronomers. Mm-hmm. And do you know where the origin of the name Milky Way comes from?
I bet you're going to tell me.
Of course.
Of course.
And of course, if I'm going to intro it like that,
no.
It's got to be Greek.
I knew it.
You knew it. You knew it was going to be Greek in
right
origin.
Right when you got all smug. I knew.
Hey, it's my people. You know, they did a lot of stuff.
Totally. Democracy and the Milky Way.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So the Milky Way. Now, so the ancient Greeks, they thought that somebody had spilled milk up in the heavens. That's what it looked like to them. But it's really billions and billions of stars in our galaxy. And so the word galaxy in Greek is a derivative of the word for milk.
Oh.
So that's where the word galaxy comes from. It is literally a Milky Way.
Well, is it like double named then? Like saying Milky Way galaxy is that just saying like Milky Way? Essentially?
Milky Way milk. Yep. I know. Yeah. Redundance.
Oh,
that's what Americans do. Greeks wouldn't have been redundant.
We ruined it.
Yep. From the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio, this is Looking Up. I'm Dean Regas, co-host of Stargazers on PBS.
And I'm Anna Heeman, and we're both from the Cincinnati Observatory. In this episode, Scott Fire-Robin from the International Dark Sky Association joins us to talk about the hazards of light pollution. So what's with the milk part? How'd the milk get there?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that
question. Wow.
Because it goes back to Greek mythology.
Oh, my God.
Here comes smug face again.
Greek
mythology. So we go back 2,500 years or so, and we go to this myth of Heracles.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually, I don't know how appropriate this is for all audiences. This is the Greek mythology can get a little,
it's going to get weird.
PG-13 possibly. Now, Heracles, as you know him, Hercules,
mm-hmm.
notice the first four letters of his name, Hera.
Right.
Hera, it was not his mom.
Mm-hmm.
His dad was Zeus,
right.
who was married to Hera, making Heracles an illegitimate child. But they gave him the name Heracles just to dig the dagger into Hera even more.
She deserved it, though. She was kind of like, she was kind of a mean person.
She did have her meanness,
mean goddess.
Mean goddess.
Whatever. I'm just saying. Okay, that is a little much. Fine, fair enough.
But so that was
gotta
an
sit
even
together
bigger
girls.
Dig into Hera.
Yeah.
And so one day, Heracles was, as a baby, was so hungry.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Zeus took him up to Mount Olympus while Hera was sleeping, he suckled at Hera.
Wow.
Hera woke up, pushed the baby away from her, and milk spurted out into the sky, and that became the Milky Way.
Oh, my gosh.
Isn't that amazing?
It's super scientifically accurate, too, which I really appreciate.
Exactly.
I like that you're very, science-based until it's like, well, you know, the Greeks said.
Well,
and then it's like, we just put that all out the window.
That's right.
It was actually a baby. So, okay.
Yeah.
That's a nice story, though.
I don't know about nice, but it's very far-fetched. It definitely sold some books back then, I'm sure, if you
sure.
talk about that story.
Good story.
But other cultures, they would see it differently. They saw it not spilled milk, but some mm-hmm. of them thought it was ashes from a fire that were up there.
Oh.
Or fireflies or
that's pretty.
Other different things up there, but the galaxy is what we get today.
Oh yeah, it is a pretty in the pictures I've seen. I guess I should go and actually look at it.
You should
I thought you could only see it in certain parts of the country or whatever.
Well, there's definitely places that are better to see than others.
Okay.
So if you're in the city, there's no way you're going to see it. There's too much light pollution. All those lights of the street lights and the city lights
mm-hmm.
just wash out all those stars there. So you do have to get out of the city, usually about 30 or 40 miles from any metropolitan area.
Mm-hmm.
But you can, if you really want to get into it, you can check out one of those satellite maps of the United States at night.
Oh, yeah.
Because what you can see is all the lights that are of the cities that are all lit up, and you can find the areas of the country that are totally dark. There's no lights on them.
Mm-hmm.
So in Ohio, southeastern Ohio is a little bit darker than most of the rest of the state. But the places that people really go to if they want to get away from it all, they would go to Upper Peninsula, Michigan, very far north, Minnesota, eastern Washington, eastern Oregon, then southwest, Arizona and California border. Or then you might as well just get on a boat and go sailing in the Pacific. How about that?
Yeah, I mean, that I'm fine with.
Okay, you go
for
that.
I mean, that sounds fun. You know, something I think is interesting, too, is we talk about light pollution. And when I first started at the observatory a little while ago, I thought air pollution, we're talking about air pollution, which we're really not. We're talking about the fact that when you're in a neighborhood or even somewhere, not like, you know, Times Square, but even in a neighborhood, there's too much light around to be able to see something that's that. Is it because it's so far away or is it because it's just faint anyway?
Well, it's because
aren't we in it? What's happening?
Are we
in the Milky Way?
We are in the Milky Way. That's right.
Oh my gosh! I just like
whoa. It's just happened.
My own head exploded. I just was like went from somewhere very simple to somewhere very complicated.
No, all right. Well, that's good. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the Milky Way.
Yeah.
Because so when you see the Milky Way across the sky, it just looks like this band of light that goes from one side to the other.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the galaxy we live in. And so you may have seen pictures of the Milky Way, like this big spiral galaxy, this pinwheel of 200 billion stars that are circling.
It's a pretty
around.
Picture, right?
Yeah, it is a pretty picture. But how did we get that picture?
Yeah.
We didn't like send a spacecraft all the way out of the galaxy and turn around and take a selfie. We didn't do that.
Oh
so,
my God.
So actually, we don't know what our galaxy looks like to the extent that we know what other galaxies look like. So like if we see pictures of the Andromeda galaxy, that's since it's outside of our galaxy, we can see the whole thing.
Right.
But we're inside this, we're embedded in those 200 billion stars. So our map of the Milky Way is not as good as it could be. We can like say, okay, those stars are in that direction, that distance, and they can make a map from the inside out. But does it really look like that? We're not sure, actually. Mm-hmm. I know. And actually, our map of our idea of what the Milky Way is, it's changed quite a bit over the last couple decades that we thought the whole universe was the Milky Way. And then we thought that we were just a perfect spiral of of stars.
Mm-hmm.
And now we think we're a barred spiral with a big bar of stars going through the center. And of course, then there's the big black hole at the center of the galaxy.
Oh, God.
It's too much. I know it's too much.
It really, really is too much. I just want to have a lighthearted conversation, and you've got to pull out black holes.
That's right. Well, that would be another topic, but let's get back to the stars. You know,
let's do the fun part.
So,
yeah,
yeah, I think you definitely need to get out and see the Milky Way. I haven't done it. I haven't been out in a while, and it's something for summertime that I always try to make it a point to go visit some of the national parks and get way out of the city as much as possible because. It's something we've lost. It's, you know, that you can go outside and in Cincinnati, we see maybe 100 stars, maybe 200 stars if we're lucky.
Right.
But, you know, if you were in a dark sky with no light pollution, you could see thousands of stars. It's almost frightening how many stars there are out there. You can see how people are inspired by it.
I like that you're like, it's terrible how many stars you can see. It's a real problem. It's supposed to be beautiful. I grew up in the country and I could, you know, we did have some starry nights. And stuff. I'm sure I saw the Milky Way at some point. And we'd like watch for like, you know, if there's a meteor shower or something like that, that's fun. But like, I feel like it's a beautiful thing. I just don't remember seeing the Milky Way.
No, I think it is. And that's, you know, the part that.
Now it's frightening to me though.
Oh, did I play up that much?
You said it was frightening how many stars there were.
Well, I mean,
it wasn't until you said that.
It's easy to picture like hundreds of things, but thousands of things that are shining at you. I mean, it's you do.
That's like my dream.
That's right.
Things shiny all over the place.
That's
I love
true.
It.
That's true. Boy, you would be distracted the whole
like
night.
Sequins.
I'd be like, Anna,
and I'd be
focus,
like, not now,
focus.
Not now.
There's too many shiny things.
so many sparkling objects.
All right. Well, maybe you'll have to go on your own then.
I'm going to take you.
Well, I'm going to be terrified, and you're going to be
that's
like
right. This is gorgeous.
ADHD out there,
exactly.
So it's going to be But I can't wait to go out this summer and check these out and see what the stars were really supposed to be like. Well, it might not be the first kind of pollution you think of when talking about pollution, but there are some serious environmental hazards associated with light pollution, and some other consequences we'll discuss with our guest, Scott Feyerabend, the executive director of the International Dark Sky Association. Scott, how are you doing?
What's going on, brother?
Oh, not too much. How you been?
I'm doing A-okay.
That's good. That's good.
Good to hear your voice.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. And I've got Anna Heyman here with me as well.
Hello.
Hey, Anna, I understand you're a dummy like me. We don't do astronomy and stuff like that. We're just kind of like plain folk, right?
That's right, but we have looks and charm, so it's fine.
Well, you may have the looks and charm, but I don't know about your colleague there.
That's a good point, right. You know?
Yep.
That's funny.
So
Dean, you must have checked out the eclipse. You must have been dead zero, right?
Oh, of course. Yeah, I was in Kentucky and got to see the whole thing. It was awesome. How about you?
No, I was in Florida. We had an 80% event, but the beer and the rum kind of took us.
There we go.
Made up for the 13% that we didn't see.
That's right.
So, that's a viewing party.
That's the Scott I know.
That's right.
That's funny.
Well, thanks for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure.
So, yeah, we're just going to talk about IDA and a few other things and, you know, look at about 8 minutes or so.
That sounds good.
Is that cool?
I've got this awesome tome in front of me entitled 100 Things to See in the Night Sky.
Oh, geez.
The author's name is crossed out. It's kind of like one of those international, you know, do not read symbols. So I figured it was a pretty good study. So right. I've got that here in hand in case.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
That's the way you, that's how you butter up the interviewer right there. That's the way you do it. All right. Well, are you ready to go?
Whenever you are.
Okay. All right. Well, Scott, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Dean. Great to hear your voice again.
Well, tell us all about the International Dark Sky Association.
Well, we could sing happy birthday because this year we're celebrating our 30th anniversary.
All right.
That's awesome.
Yeah, 1988. Thanks a lot. and we've been looking back over our 30-year history, and one of the things that the organization, a nonprofit here based in Tucson, is all about is trying to change humans' relationship to light at night. And we're looking back at some of the stories and some of the changes that have taken place in industry and a lot of the publicity that light pollution is getting these days. And we feel like we've done a pretty doggone good job of helping to inform and educate the public about light pollution and its many, many environmental consequences and downsides. So we're going to pat ourselves on the back. We have a lot more work to go, but we're feeling good about our first 30 years here on planet Earth.
So, Scott, for city dwellers, what are your tips for seeing a truly starry sky?
Get the hell out of Dodge.
I thought you were going to say that.
Unfortunately, and this is a big challenge for IDA and for our mission and our programs. Well, first, to answer your question seriously, yeah, unfortunately, folks have to travel farther and farther away from urban centers to really enjoy and relish and just partake in the magic of a truly night sky. I've got a loyal supporter who lives in Los Angeles, and every time I call him up to thank him for his donation each year, he says, Scott, I have to travel another hour and a half out of L.A. to get to the really, really dark skies. That he's an astronomer, and that's Exhibit A in terms of the issues that we have to deal with. And the other point that I would make is that part of our job is to educate and help the public understand what small specks we are in this universe and the grandeur of the night skies above us. And you know, for urban dwellers, unless we can break through that sky glow that they experience day in and day out and help them understand what's above them and what they're missing, it's really hard to get somebody invested in the sort of work that we do and want to protect night skies unless they know what's up there and help them understand just how incredible the stars are. So we've got a lot of work to go, as I said at the top of the call, to educate and inform those folks. And once they're in the family, you know, watch out. They become some of our strongest advocates and champions. So.
Yeah, because I think that some folks don't realize that there's different kinds of skies that you need to see a, especially dark skies to be able to see certain things. I mean, as the non-astronomer on our podcast, that's definitely something that is sort of news to me. So it's cool that you guys are educating folks about that for sure.
Yeah, well, thanks.
Well, so luckily there are lots of places in America that are being preserved for dark skies. And I met you, Scott, at the Grand Canyon Star Party a few years ago. And man, it got dark out there. And so, like, tell us about what the national parks are doing. And, you know, can they become official dark sky sites?
Thanks for the question. You know, we have a great program called the International Dark Sky Places Program, which is a fairly rigorous and intense program that basically certifies and designates dark sky places. And it can run the continuum from dark sky reserves to dark sky parks to dark sky communities. The criteria vary from situation to situation. And it really is. It takes from beginning to end through the application process, it takes sometimes well over a year because sky glow measurements have to be submitted. There has to be documentation that the community is committed to protecting the night sky once the designation is provided and so on and so forth. And one of our strongest partners has been the National Park Service and Grand Canyon, where I first met Dean, they were being recognized for a provisional dark sky certification. They had made a huge progress, and we wanted to celebrate with them the work done there, and this year, I think, is their 100th anniversary, and they will complete the designation. But the national parks recognize that not only is protecting and preserving, you know, the natural resources, plants and animals, water quality and air quality is important to their mission, but they've also come to realize and appreciate that protecting soundscapes and the nightscapes are part of their mission as well. And so they've become very strong partners of IDA in designating national parks as part of the International Dark Sky Places program under the parks provision. And before you ask the question, Dean, I can't tell you how many national parks we've got designated at this point, but we are strong partners with the National Park Service. And if I could go on just a little bit more, it's really encouraging because other federal agencies that are huge land managers, the U.S. Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, that oversee and manage vast tracts of public lands are also now becoming interested in joining a partnership with IDA to perhaps look at designating some of those lands as dark sky places, which would just be a huge, huge accomplishment.
That's great. So, Scott, now you have a wildlife and biology background, as I understand it. So I have to ask, how did you get in with the astronomy crowd? With the cool kids.
Oh, yeah. The rough kids, yeah.
That's right.
Don't jump to conclusions here. Oh. Well, it's an interesting question, and I'm going to kind of take a little side tour here. Mm-hmm. So I've worked in the nonprofit environmental conservation community. Coming up on 35 years, I've started working with the National Wildlife Federation in Washington, D.C. for 15 or 20 years, and with the Nature Conservancy up in Alaska, and a bunch of other groups. Worked my way down to California, and it came time for me to, you know, shift gears, and so I started looking around and researching other organizations where maybe my skills could come into play, and I stumbled across the International Dark Sky Association. I thought, man, this must be a bunch of druids that, you know, put mud on their faces and dance around trees at night. Well, what was so amazing is for 32, 33 years of my career, I had never heard or understood that there is a thing called light pollution. I, you know, worked with air quality issues, groundwater quality issues, soil pollution, and I'd never heard of light pollution. And so, again, I'm kind of exhibit A in terms of the challenges that this organization has to educate people. And once you see light pollution, you know what it is, and more importantly, how easily it can be remedied. it becomes a kind of a no-brainer. But my career in wildlife biology, it was they were looking for somebody that not only could get the organization kind of back up on the rails operationally and financially, but I think they were looking for somebody that brought a different set of skills and professional background into the organization. And as folks know, or if they don't know, artificial light at night has huge consequences for all walks of fish and wildlife resources, and so I think I brought that aspect of my background into the organization to help build out our community of activists and people who care about light pollution and trying to do something about it.
Well, and so the IDA is kind of based in Tucson, Arizona, and that city itself has taken all these great strides to keep the sky dark. I mean, they have all the observatories nearby. What are some of the steps that they've done that other cities could replicate?
Right, and that's actually a great point, Dean, because that's why IDA was founded in Tucson. Oftentimes I get the question, why in the world are you guys grounded in Tucson, when we truly are an international organization? We have board members that live in Australia and Spain, and so we are an international outfit. And it all began because of the observatories and the huge economic activity that they generate. It's on the order of billions of dollars, and the four major observatories that ring Tucson back a couple of decades ago, as Tucson started to grow up and as light pollution became a problem with the observatories, it was recognized that the city needed to get ahead of the curve because the observatories work, and importantly, the financial impact that they're having on the community was beginning to suffer. So it was at that point that Tucson developed what is still, I think, one of the best lighting ordinances in the country. And when you fly into Tucson, we're a city of well over a million. It's as one of my lighting engineer friends describes it, it's a very quiet city, and it really is, because everything is shielded. All the lighting is directed downward. It's used judiciously. It's used to light, you know, the need and the purpose at hand, and not just cast light everywhere. And so it was from that genesis that Tucson, I think, provides a great example for how other cities, big cities, can develop ordinances or practices that respect the night and protect the dark skies. And so one of the tools that we use are described as model lighting ordinances that can be used by homeowners associations, folks in small communities that want to try and protect the night sky, all the way up to big urban centers such as Chicago and Houston, which are now going through a big LED conversion project, and we're trying to inject the same sort of attention to protecting the night skies as Tucson has demonstrated.
Well, it's a great thing you guys are doing, and you know, for folks, you should definitely go visit Tucson and see the observatories. Plus, I got to put a plug, Tucson has some of the best southwestern food I've ever had.
Well, thanks.
I know that's not what you're doing, but you know, you're still part of it, I think.
I'll take credit.
That's right. That's right. Well, Scott, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I got one last quick question. I told you I was going to look at your book here, Dean. I know I'm running over. But it's
you can give
exactly
a plug to my book anytime you want.
Oh, my gosh.
It's an awesome book.
Here we go.
This is going to turn your audience on, because it'll show the level of sophistication. It says, well, first you'll learn how to safely observe the sun. So I'm blinded by that passage, and I have been looking at the sun and still haven't figured out how to observe it correctly. But anyway, I will read the rest of your book, Dean, and I'm sure I'll learn more as we go forward. So.
Oh, well, that's anyway. Good. Well, at least you can see far enough to read the book. How about that? That's good.
There you go. All right, y'all have a good day.
Scott, thanks so much for spending some time with us today.
The Cincinnati Observatory has been around since the mid-1800s, so you can only imagine the many letters we've received in that time, and some have some very interesting questions or beliefs about space and the sky, and Dean's got one he's going to share with us now, right?
Oh, yeah.
Interesting question.
Yeah, so I pulled out a question I got from a visitor that it started off as a normal question.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it seemed real legit. It was a normal question, but then it got weird really fast.
Oh.
And this is what happens when you get email questions. You know, so if somebody sends you an email, they feel a little freer to ask their, spread their theories. So the question started off with was, how come we can see Jupiter so often in the sky? Because sometimes, since Jupiter is farther from the sun than the Earth is, so sometimes it's on the other side of the sun, and the sun would be blocking it. And he thought, well, the sun should block our view of Jupiter for like half of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, Jupiter is so far away from the sun, it's only about 1 month or 2 months where you can't see it. So I wrote to him, I said, yeah, you know, it's hard to imagine the scale of the solar system. You know, Jupiter is 500 million miles away from us. And so it's only blocked by the sun for about a month or two. And so I said, thanks very much for the question. It was cool to think of this. But yeah, try to picture that you can see Jupiter in the daytime, or you can see Jupiter in the daytime sometimes, and the nighttime sometimes, and morning and evening. And thanks and keep looking up and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and then you're like, case closed.
Case closed, but no.
And then you felt good.
I did.
You were like, I've shared some knowledge.
That's right. That's
with
right.
somebody with a genuinely interesting question.
And then it got wacky.
And then the wheels came off.
Because then he said, okay. No, you're wrong. And
strike one, buddy.
Here's my, yeah, never start with that.
This is Dean Regas you're talking,
that's right.
talking to.
That's right. So no, you're wrong. And here's my theory. And he built a whole website as to what is going on in the real thing.
So he didn't share the website in the first email.
No, he wanted
just, like,
to
keep it at G. He's like, this is fine.
Yeah, he wanted a legitimate answer, right. I guess. You know, he didn't want to influence my answer with his theory. And mm-hmm. so his theory put the sun on once, and he even had like a picture. Like
oh,
a
it
whole,
was a diagram.
Yeah, it was a whole diagram. And so on
well,
the,
he wanted you to understand.
Well, just, yeah, I know you need to dumb it down for
that's
me because
right,
I didn't quite get it. So there's the sun on one side, the earth on the other side, and his theory is the earth does not move, or at least it does not go around the sun. It mm-hmm. just goes in this figure eight pattern back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And then all the planets that are away from us do the same thing, and they do a figure eight back and forth, back and forth. And that's why we can see Jupiter so often in the night sky. So I wrote back to him again.
Of course. Oh,
and just to say, well, that's an interesting theory, but, you know, like, it's pretty, you know, I was trying to give him the benefit of the doubt. I was like, you know, we're pretty sure we go around the sun. I mean, like, there's lots of evidence, and I listed all the evidence of why it goes around. And I said, you know, like, we figured this out like 400 years ago. Galileo saw Venus going around the sun, that it changes its shape. And, your theory is very interesting, but it doesn't hold true.
It's so wrong.
Yeah. Well, I was being nice with the emails.
Oh, you're being nice.
I was like, that's a very interesting theory, but yeah, it doesn't hold up to the observational data.
And then
he writes back, he said, so when did we figure this out? And I wrote back, 400 years ago.
Oh,
Galileo,
man.
Look
mic
it
drop.
Up. I know, I did. That mic drop.
That's good.
And so we went back and forth a few other times where he's like, well, that doesn't explain us going around the sun. And I said, well, this is what I see. And so, observational evidence is in our favor. And he wasn't able to. So then I asked him lots of questions about his theory. I said, so if this is the case, then what you should observe this.
Because you want people to like, they have to meet all these criteria, right? To
exactly.
like, if they're going to say you're wrong or modern thought is wrong, not you're wrong. It's not personal. But
I guess I maybe got a little personal. It's possible. It's just
it could have happened.
My professional integrity may have been questioned. And so I might have fought back slightly more vehemently than normal.
Oh,
but
man.
In the end, he failed to answer my questions.
Oh.
And
reply.
So he stopped writing back. So that was my new method of dealing with the crank drawer, is just keep asking question after question after question until they can't
just
answer.
Wear them down.
Oh, yeah. I wore them down.
I like
and,
it.
So he probably has his own podcast telling how wrong this interaction with the stupid observatory astronomer was. And
possible.
And he didn't get it. He's like, yeah, that guy never got my theory. That's for sure. I mean, obviously.
It's too advanced for you.
Right. The Earth goes in a figure eight back and forth and back and forth. And
should we be dizzy if that's the case? Like, I feel exhausted by
I
that
know.
Idea.
I know.
I don't know.
Boy. Well, I hope
you
I
tried.
Made, I hope I tried.
Yeah.
That's all I can do. That's all you can do.
That's it for this episode of Looking Up. Thanks to Scott Fire Robin for joining us. Get in touch with us. We're on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/lookingupwvxu. And we're on Twitter at Looking Up Podcast. You can also drop us a note at lookingup@wvxu.org.
And we love questions. Even if they're wacky, send us your questions or topic suggestions, or ask your kids what they'd like to ask an astronomer or scientist, and we can try to answer it on future episodes.
And remember to subscribe to Looking Up on iTunes, and please take a moment to rate or comment on us there, or check us out on Stitcher, and you can also find us at wvxu.org/lookingup. Our theme song and additional music is by Y, that's W-H-Y question mark, from their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recordings and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds is our producer, Josh Elstrow is our engineer, and Jim Nolan provided additional technical assistance.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Anna Heeman.
And I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.